This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This week on Witness History. In 2011, Japanese tidying expert Marie Kondo released her debut book and became an organising icon around the world. Her method focuses on only keeping items that spark joy and speak to your heart. Now a best-selling author, award nominee and household name, she tells us how she's a little more relaxed about tidying since having children. Search and subscribe to Witness History wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you okay? And recording?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna go. Off I go.
There was a really bizarre moment which was concreted in my mind, and I remember thinking a very specific thought that this is how I die, and that's a shame.
That's Niall McCann. What you've just heard is him crashing into a mountain at 50 miles an hour. The story you're about to listen to is not an easy one to hear. Niall talks about his devastating accident, which remarkably he survives. He speaks too in some detail about his surgery and recovery. We hear how he learns to cope with and sometimes even laugh about the very serious injuries that have changed his life.
I'm going to embrace the fact that I have bladder incontinence and bowel incontinence and sexual dysfunction because I can, and I really hope that other people feel that that gives them the permission to embrace it too.
I meet him at his home in Newport, South Wales.
Hi, Smitha. Come on in. Funny how we shook hands even though it's ready. Right, what do you want? We've got every possible way of making coffee.
I count 1, 2, 3, 4 different ways of making coffee. 5.
5.
Wow, I'll just have a long black, please.
Right, coming right up there. Smitha, that one's yours.
Thank you.
There you go, you're welcome.
Can we start with that day in May 2016?
Yeah, it was... Oh, I've been looking forward to it for so long, getting the opportunity to fly off the summit of Penavan, the highest mountain in South Wales. It's very rare that the winds are coming from the perfect direction to be able to safely fly off that summit. But all of a sudden, May the 6th, 2016, the winds had switched round to the northeast, and my brother and I decided that we were going to fly off the summit on our speed wings. Instead of floating around and enjoying the view, as people do with a paraglider, with a speed wing, you run or you ski off a mountain and you plummet down it at about 50 miles an hour. My issue that day was trying to be a hero, and really I was a beginner. And so I took off full of confidence, full of bravado, and I pulled a big 90-degree turn to stay as close to the face as I possibly could. And then I went to pull another 180-degree turn, and I accidentally went a few degrees too far. So all of a sudden, I was facing the cliff, and I realised that there was nothing I could do to pull out of that. And then at the very last second, I lifted my legs up, and that meant that my bum impacted the ground first, as opposed to my legs. That probably saved my legs, but it definitely put a lot of pressure on my back, which exploded. And I bounced back, and I started to tumble. And knowing the profile of that mountain, I knew that the only way I was going to come out of that was in several pieces at the bottom. But remarkably, I snagged something, my parachute or some other part of my body, and I came to a stop. Again, I remember a very specific moment where I fought to stay alive. And then that moment passed. It was almost as though it was like a build-up of pressure that was then released, and I was alive. And then I set about trying to sort myself out. I had a camera on my head, and I just never stopped it running.
What's going through your head at that point?
What was actually going through my head was I really want to be able to let my brother know that I'm alive, because he's going to be rather worried. He was going to wait for me to land and then he'd come down afterwards. I went around a corner out of his view, but someone else was watching and shouted, "He's crashed." And then instantly he just sprung into action.
Hi there, my brother has crashed a paragliding wing. I'm on the east face, the northeast face of Penavan. Sorry, you're breaking up, I can't hear you. Okay. Niall! Niall! Yeah. he has impacted the ground hard. I'm just making my way down to him now, so I don't know what state he's in, but he's not well.
And he got to me, and in my head, I was just sitting casually, looking up the mountain, watching him come. But having looked back at the footage, I was in a crumpled heap. I interrupted him. I said, no, don't call them yet.
Don't call them yet, Ben.
I might be able to walk out of here.
I'm with him now. He is conscious. He is breathing. There is a lot of blood, mainly from his head, but it doesn't look like too deep an injury. It's his lower back that's in a lot of pain.
But I can feel my toes, and I can move.
He can move his toes. He can move his legs. That's him talking. We're just getting a space blanket on top of him.
How long was it before the rescue team got to you?
We only know this by looking back at the footage, but it was 40 minutes. I was able to tell them, I'm in the mountain rescue team. We need the mountain rescue team to come out and get me.
I'm Dr. Rob Powell, team leader of Brecon Mountain Rescue and a GP. And I was lying on the floor between rocks. It's not a nice environment, the north face of Penavan, so it was in quite a precarious position. And we also had a helicopter above us who had winched us down, so the wind was quite intense at that point.
What are we going to do then, Niall? Okay, Bentox is coming. I've got some morphine as well. Okay, so what we'll maybe do, get a line in.
So initially we did a top-to-toe survey of Niall. We did give him some pain relief.
Okay, and then we'll get this back on.
We were able, between the few of us there, to lift him into a mattress that goes around him, and then you vacuum it up and it goes solid to stop him moving, stop that spine having any further movement. And so when he gets to hospital, he can be fully assessed. It is absolutely amazing that somebody with that impact of injury came away with just spinal injuries. I would have thought from the other side of the mountain looking at it, we were going into a situation which probably wasn't survivable.
What was it like when you saw the mountain rescue team?
Well, we actually shared a bit of a joke. It wasn't the first time that they'd rescued me.
What?
I told you I wasn't very good at flying. But in this instance, it rapidly became clear that it was a bit more of a serious case. And Rob was clearly quite concerned.
You get into the helicopter, they lift you into the helicopter.
Get you into the helicopter, plunk you down, and then 14 minutes back to Cardiff again. My brother had already got there, so that was the point where I said, would you mind calling my wife? She works in the hospital. She was 4 minutes away. I remember her arriving at the room and immediately breaking into tears and coming to me and me lying to her and saying, don't worry, I'm fine. And then saying, and I've given up speed flying, which I think was a bit of a relief. At that point, we still didn't really know what was wrong with me.
When did you start to understand what had gone on?
A few minutes later, when a cabal of concerned-looking doctors appeared at my bedside with the news that I had to be prepared that I might never walk again. And I remember when they said that, I responded instantly and saying, that's all right. I've led an amazing life.
That is an incredibly positive reaction.
I was, for whatever reason, just immediately reconciled to my position. And I felt that if anyone was going to enjoy their life without the use of their legs, it was going to be me.
You're standing in front of me, clearly walking. What are the next things that happen?
The first operation was on the day of the accident.
Uh-huh.
I was wheeled in, face down, and they unzip you. What they discovered was that I'd snapped in half and then twisted.
I think I was on call, and I think I was on my way home when I was called to resus for some crazy guy that apparently been trying to fly down a mountain, and he crashed and apparently had come in paralysed.
That's Michael McCarthy, consultant spinal surgeon at the University Hospital of Wales in Cardiff.
Niall had multiple injuries, but his main injury was an L1 burst fracture.
What does that mean?
So, yes, exactly. So the spine has got 7 cervical or neck vertebrae, 12 thoracic or chest vertebrae, and then 5 lumbar vertebrae before you get to your pelvis. So he managed to break or fracture, it's the same thing, his L1 vertebrae. as Niall, I'm sure, would have told you, I might have said his spine had exploded. He'd also, because of the nature of his injury, the top part of his spine had gone forwards on the bottom part of his spine. So that's what we call a dislocation. The aim that evening was to realign his spine. His spine was bent. There was pressure on his spinal cord. We want to straighten his spine and fix it in that position. And we did get a CT scan and an MRI scan to check everything. And as expected, he had bruised his spinal cord.
So I was on my back, completely on my back, for 19 days. But on day 4, I was able to lift my leg from the hip. And that was a sign that there's enough nervous information going from my spinal cord
down
to my legs. Some of them are working. The ones that are really badly damaged are the ones that are down my posterior chain. My calf, my hamstrings, and my glutes. One of the things that also happens when you break your back is you cannot control when you break wind. Hence, that just happened. So I was able to lift my leg after about 4 days. What they weren't able to do was access an enormous number of fragments of my, in their words, obliterated vertebra, which were around the front of my spine. So they couldn't access that from the back. So I needed to go in for a second operation to take out all of the fragments of that obliterated vertebra. So that operation was due to take place 6 days later. But on the morning of that operation, my surgeon was rear-ended by an off-duty police officer on his way to work. So he quite sensibly decided it was not wise to go fiddling around in my spine. So it was delayed another 10 or 11 days, during which point they moved me to another hospital. I was adamant that I should stay where my wife works. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of reasons for me to want to be there. There's lots of people around, and I felt that was having a really positive impact on my mental health. Mm-hmm. My surgeon recognised in me that what I needed was to be surrounded by patients who were much better than I was. The ward that I was in was a trauma ward, so everyone was really, really unwell. And I was one of the more well people. And it's quite easy to be depressed by the really negative things happening to the people around you. And he moved me to a place where people were having shoulder surgery or they'd just broken an arm. And all of a sudden I was to be surrounded by people that were fine, ostensibly. And honestly, I believe that non-medical intervention was as important for my recovery as the medical side of what he did. And it's
interesting. How did you feel once you got to that ward then?
It was like a weight coming off my shoulders.
Huh.
So I was moved to that hospital to have this second operation, which is quite elaborate. They open you up, slice into your torso around the rib cage on the left-hand side for me, and they chop out your 11th rib. And then they pull all the bits out of your spine. They put in a titanium cage where that vertebra used to be. They then pack that with your own bone that they crush up and they stitch you up, and Bob's your uncle.
Here's Niall's surgeon, Michael McCarthy, again.
So in effect, you get a fusion through the cage and through the bone graft. But, as you know, his spinal cord was bruised, and that bruising is the thing that takes time, years and years, to recover.
Niall's story to me seems remarkable and quite unique. What is the reality for most people who have a spinal cord injury?
So Niall was exceedingly lucky in that his spinal injury was at the lower end of his spinal cord. The majority of people with spinal cord injuries may not be as lucky and may have far worse and persistent neurological symptoms. The degree of those injuries will, of course, affect your psychological well-being. With Niall, he's just a different breed. He would always be positive. But with lots of people, they may be very positive people, but spinal cord injuries, the bottom line is, they can be absolutely devastating and cause a significant psychological burden, significant health burden, economic burden on both the patient, their loved ones, their family, their friends. So we mustn't forget that in amongst all of this great story of Niall and his spinal cord injury.
At this point, after my second operation, I was still feeling worse and worse. And the main reason behind that was because my guts had suffered what's known as an ileus, which is where
they stop working.
So I hadn't been able to go to the toilet for, at this point, 21 days. And I would not recommend that. Yes. And three physios came to prop me up. So one on either side and one behind, and they propped me up. Then standing up, I remember stood up for the first time after 19 days, and they shuffled me 2 steps to the left, like 2 inches a step, and then 2 steps back to the right, and then sat me back down again, and I passed out asleep for 2 minutes.
You passed out?
And then the next day they did the same.
This is something that actually on the day of your accident you thought you might never do again.
So it was nice to be able to walk again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that immediately gave me some targets. But the other thing that walking did was that it stimulated my bowels. 21 days and 12 hours later, I finally did pass my first... Well, it was, I imagine it was like giving a child, giving birth to a child. Just a much wetter child.
And, a significant moment.
Oh, but it was wonderful. And I was alone at the time. I'd been... It was the closest I'd come to despondency through the entire process.
That is remarkable. You've been told you might not walk again. It's the trouble with your bowels that I'm getting the sense.
Oh, totally.
What was causing you the most upset?
Such discomfort as well. Real discomfort. And then it's all very funny. And of course, you can edit this out. But my brothers had visited me that day. And it was the least engaging I had been able to be for 21 days. I could barely speak. I was in and out of consciousness. And I was really verging on losing my sense of humour at this point. I was feeling that bad. And they gave me this gastrographin. And what gastrographin does is it sucks fluid in from the rest of your body into your gut and tries to soften the concrete that is in there. And my brothers had left and I'd been lying alone. And I was on my back. And bear in mind, I'd been only on my back for the previous 21 days. But this was the first time I felt I had the strength to roll to my side. So I was lying on my back, feeling awful, just feeling absolutely awful.
I think I can tell what's coming.
Yeah. And I rolled to my side and I just heard this growl.
That was the sweet sound to your ears.
Nervous.
Your sense of that.
No idea what this awful sound was. And I just kind of, I lay there on my side and just, yeah, awaiting something. My wonderful nurse, Cindy, appeared at the door. Shaft of light behind us, silhouetted, and she just looked across at me and went, "Oh, Niall, it's begun." And then she came up to me and uttered the most wonderful words, "Would you like me to take a photograph?"
Are you joking?
No. I handed her my phone, she took a photograph, and I uploaded the photograph to the family WhatsApp.
And to you, that was the prettiest picture you'd seen in a while.
I still have it on my phone. And yeah, so it was...
I won't look.
It was from that point on things just finally start getting better. So I was standing again. I was able to go to the toilet again. I was actually able to start recovering. And it was a truly seminal moment when that did happen. But then I set myself various little challenges. The Llandoch Hospital in West Cardiff has the second longest corridor in Western Europe. And I set myself the challenge, famously so, it almost made it into the Guinness Book of Records once.
How long is that then?
It was about 800 metres long. So I set myself the challenge of walking it at some point before I left. So I started walking with a Zimmer frame and three physios. And then slowly you get two physios, then one, and then just you with a Zimmer frame. And then you switch from a Zimmer frame to crutches. And then from two crutches to one crutch. And then from using that crutch to just holding it.
How did that feel?
That sense of freedom again. And seeing birds was a really big thing. In the hospital I got moved to, there was a tree outside my window. And my bird list achieved 4 species, but still that was better than none. And so just being able to see trees, getting the wind on your face, being able to move was just wonderful.
What are you thinking your future's going to look like?
At this stage, it was still quite unclear what my future would look like. But I'd reconciled to the fact that I might never walk again. And then when it became apparent that I would, and did, then I set myself 2 challenges. First thing I wanted to do... Well, 3 challenges. First thing I wanted to do was walk the length of Western Europe's second longest corridor.
Which you did.
Which I managed to do the day before I left hospital. So after 37 days, I managed to walk that. Then I wanted to walk back up to the summit of Penavan, where I'd had my accident. And the third thing I wanted to do, if I ever got fit and strong enough again, was to join the mountain rescue team that had rescued me.
And you did all 3.
One after the other. Knocked them all off.
You left hospital after just 38 days. That's remarkable.
And I could probably have done with being in hospital for a couple of weeks longer, because I'm still really unwell.
You wanted to escape.
But I desperately wanted to escape. And, oh, goodness, that first drive home, jubilation tinged with agony, because every speed hump we went over...
You felt
it. Oh, my goodness. Absolutely awful. And then, yeah, moved into a downstairs bed, because, of course, stairs are out of the question for some time. And a little glass of champagne that day, but really, I just wanted to pass out and go to sleep.
How do you learn to manage?
How graphic do you want to get?
Hey, we're a health programme.
So the main lasting effects for me that are most inconvenient from a day-to-day basis are that I can't relax my bladder to take a pee, and I can't tense my bowel to take a poo. Now, with the bladder, normally your bladder sphincter will be contracted.
Because it's like a bag with a tight bit at the bottom to keep it closed, and you need to relax it to let the urine out.
I can't do that. So the way I do that is I use a catheter. I put a little tube into the end of my penis, and it goes into my bladder, and that allows my bladder to drain. And I do that whenever I need to. Managing your bowels is different. So again, you need to be able to relax your anal sphincter, but you also then need to be able to push. And as a spinal cord injury patient, I don't have any control over my anal sphincter, and I can't push.
Because the nerves are damaged to that bit.
Yeah, so... What most spinal cord injury patients do is they manually evacuate. So they use their finger and they pull out whatever is in the rectum at that time. And for me, that took a while to be able to do that. I had a lot of very liquid stool trying to come out, and it just would come out all the time. And the funniest of those moments was... About two and a half weeks after my accident, I was up at my mum's house and I'd gone to visit, and my brother was there, the brother that had been with me on the accident, Finn. And at this point, I had just started doing my first push-ups because I wanted to get strong again.
You were doing push-ups?
So yeah, I did one, and then I did five, and then I did 10. So I was just getting into that. And I came to mum's house, and my brother had a pull-up bar on the doorframe, kind of like
oh,
I do.
Oh, no. So, I see where this is going.
So I wanted to see whether I could do my first pull-up. So I slowly did the pull-up and got to my chin to the top and came back down. I was like, yes, I did it. Fantastic. And then I thought, well, that was a lot of pressure across my core. I'd better just check whether or not my nappy is full, because at this point I was still having to wear a nappy all the time. And so I quickly just pulled my trousers down and looked at my nappy between my legs, and I could see, oh, no, it's fine. Nothing in there. But my brother was stood directly behind me, and he watched as I curled out a very large stool on my mum's dining room floor. And so that type of accident would happen all the time for months. I just didn't have control.
How does it feel to have these accidents?
Ah,
well, you're a grown man. You're used to being independent. You know, we talk about accidents. Normally, we're talking about babies, toddlers, sort of still learning, and... How does it feel to have lost that particular part of your independence?
It's hard to feel good about yourself with a poo in your pants. Let's put it that way. But I also knew that this is just a part of my accident. This is a byproduct of my accident. And this is something I just have to learn to manage. And so it went from being daily to weekly to monthly to once every 6 months. And these days, the only time it happens is when I run. So even if I go to the toilet directly before running... After about half an hour, undoubtedly, a bolus will have made its way down into my rectum anyway. And then at that point, I don't get any signal.
You can't tell.
I can't tell. I don't know that my bowel is full. So I'll be running, and almost invariably, if I'm running over half an hour, I will soil myself. And so I just have to accept that. That is just a part of my reality. Because I run three times a week. And so I soil myself two or three times a week. So I wear a pad, essentially a nappy. Part of my routine is come home, manually evacuate the rest, put the nappy in the bin, have a shower. And really, it's barely an imposition.
You mentioned for many people who've damaged their spinal cord that sexual function, there can be issues there too. Mm-hmm.
Well, for every spinal cord injury patient, it will be unique. So everyone will have something slightly different. So some people it will be an inability to get aroused. For others, it will be intermittent ejaculation, so you may or may not ejaculate. For others, it might be some other issue. One of the things that was really important for me and my wife was to return to having an intimate relationship. When I first had my accident, I just didn't know what was going to be possible. And no one really talked about it. none of my doctors talked about it, and I just didn't know what was going to happen. So actually the first time I did get an erection was a surprise. I was like, whoa, well, I wasn't sure that was going to happen again. Mm-hmm. Great. Mm-hmm. That's a bonus that I wasn't sure was going to be there. And yeah, it really felt like learning by doing again, kind of like being a teenager, just learning what works, what feels nice. And it's not easy. That, I would say, is one of the trickier aspects of my injury, is managing that sexual dysfunction. And so having an open dialogue has been really important.
You speak very frankly about the ways this injury has affected you.
I know that I'm in a really fortunate position of being able to talk frankly about the consequences of my injury. But I also know that a lot of people with spinal cord injuries don't feel that they can talk about that. And what I hope my openness does is it firstly makes them realise they're not alone, that other people have this too. And secondly, maybe gives them the permission to turn to a loved one or a friend or a family member and say, I have these problems. For a lot of people, there's still a stigma around this, but there shouldn't be. And I'm going to embrace the fact that I have bladder incontinence and bowel incontinence and sexual dysfunction, because I can.
And you've had a little girl.
Who's the best thing in the world. And we feel very lucky to have had her, because when you do have a spinal cord injury, one of the things you're told is, eventually, is that having children may not happen. And so we immediately registered for IVF. And so we were incredibly lucky that Phoebe was born on our first round of IVF. And she was born just under 3 years after my accident. And we didn't know that that was going to happen. And we feel, yeah, intensely fortunate that we have her. I put on a little seat in front of me and we go mountain biking in the hills behind the house. You think of sliding doors moments. What if moments. If I hadn't had my accident, we wouldn't have Phoebe. We probably would have had another child, but it wouldn't be Phoebe. And so for me, by far the best thing that could possibly have come from this accident is my wonderful daughter, Phoebe.
Thank you for speaking to us.
Thank you for having me.
This week on Witness History. In 2011, Japanese Tai Chi expert Marie Kondo released her debut book and became an organising icon around the world. Her method focuses on only keeping items that spark joy and speak to your heart. Now a best-selling author, award nominee and household name, she tells us how she's a little more relaxed about tidying since having children. Search and subscribe to Witness History wherever you get your podcasts.